In the coming week, the world marks the 25th anniversary of the Srebrenica massacre. Three major gas pipelines suffer setbacks, and COVID-19 triggers historic levels of food insecurity. It's July 9th, 2020, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Amy Myers Jaffe, sitting in for Jim Lindsay.
Amy is a David M. Rubenstein Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment, and she directs the program on energy security and climate change at CFR. Amy, it's great to have you on the show, and we're both doing this virtually.
Bob, it's great to be here and great to see you virtually. Let's kick off the show by talking about a notable anniversary in the coming week. That's the 25th anniversary of the Srebrenica massacre. In July 1995, more than 7,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys were killed in a genocide perpetrated by the Bosnian Serb forces. This took place in Srebrenica, a town in the east of Bosnia and Herzegovina. Tell us, Bob, about this anniversary.
Well, I should say one aspect of it, Amy, as you mentioned, it was a genocide. There have been, I believe, 15 people found guilty of that or related charges by international tribunals. But there are a great many Bosnian Serbs who do not subscribe to that view that a genocide took place. And these are Bosnian Muslim men and boys who were separated from women and children during a campaign by Bosnian Serb forces in that summer. I remember it well. I was at Radio Free Europe in those days in Prague, and there was a great deal of daily reporting about civilian casualties from the Bosnian Civil War, which was the most damaging of all the civil wars in the disintegration of the former Yugoslavia. But then came the reports out of Srebrenica, which were truly staggering, partly because people may be interested to know, these people thought they were safe. They thought they were in a UN safe zone overseen by Dutch UN peacekeepers. But when Bosnian Serb forces swept in and started to move people around, the peacekeepers did not respond. And there's a whole host of things that have happened since then. This is from an era that really kicked off a great deal of soul searching by the what we call the international community about war crimes and how they should be adjudicated. Because the same year was, or just this came 1 year after the Rwandan genocide, in which an estimated 800,000 Tutsis, mostly Tutsis, were murdered by Hutus. So what you had was this movement towards international justice. You had a great deal of soul searching by the UN system, the peacekeeping system, by the individual states that contributed to that. A great deal of activities by the Dutch government subsequently to examine what their role was in that. But in the UN peacekeeping system itself, looking at how they failed, and it set in motion this real momentum towards international justice. So you had tribunals set up under the oversight of the UN Security Council, or authorized by the UN Security Council for Rwanda, for the former Yugoslavia. You had momentum building towards the establishment of a permanent international court to oversee cases of the worst abuses, the International Criminal Court, which most countries, but not all, notably the U.S., is not signed on to that. But you did have this, as I said, this momentum towards trying these cases and toward this sentiment known as the responsibility to protect, which the U.N. Security Council did, albeit for a brief time, sign on to as well, that the international community had an obligation to step in when abuses were being committed. And so we have had, as I said, since the Srebrenica massacre, you've had the leaders of it. You had the political leader, Radovan Karadzic, and the military leader, Ratko Mladic, both convicted on genocide and war crimes charges. But yet you still have a population that's in denial. That being said, there is an ongoing process for the final piece of the Yugoslav disintegration. That would be the secession of Kosovo, which is a state that's recognized by about 100 or so countries. Its president, Hashim Thaci, was just notified recently that he is under investigation by another court in The Hague that's looking into charges that he was involved in abuses against more than 100 people of various ethnicity in Kosovo. So justice is seeming to live on in the case of the former Yugoslavia, but there's a great deal of commentary out there on this 25th anniversary, Amy, about how, you know, this almost seems like an anachronism that you don't have the degree of international outrage and actions to help protect the most vulnerable people as reports come in of abuses, whether it's the Chinese treatment of Uyghurs or the treatment of Rohingya in Myanmar or whatever. There doesn't seem to be the momentum, the full thrust of action and momentum to do something about it. Nor does there seem to have been a deterrent effect by some of these international tribunals to not commit these crimes. So one of the reasons he's setting up something like the ICC is that you hope that you're sending a message that, you know, these crimes will not be allowed and they will not be accepted, and even leaders of countries will face justice ultimately. So it's an anniversary with a great deal of mixed sentiment. Within Bosnia itself, it's also, while Bosnian Muslims have actually returned to live in Srebrenica, there is a Serb mayor. Bosnia itself is divided between statelets. One's mostly Bosnian Serb, one is a Croat Muslim under a broader confederation. And so it's a time of soul searching and grim memories and a great deal of thought about what is the state of international justice as we think back on Srebrenica.
So do you expect next week, will we see any kind of protests or unrest in the Bosnian context or in other parts of Europe? Or you think that it's really going to be more just a soul searching about the path forward on these last final prosecutions and so forth?
I mean, there are certainly efforts on behalf of the Bosnian Muslim community, human rights champions, and so forth, to make sure that this anniversary is marked properly. And also, there's ongoing search for the remains of those who were killed, 7,000, maybe as many as 8,000 men and boys killed during that massacre. There are still people out looking for their remains and trying to kind of repatriate them, in a sense, and reinter them. There is, again, this denial on the side of many Bosnian Serbs that this was genocide, this was happening in the fog of war, as some point out, and that, you know, that they shouldn't be vilified for this. So it could definitely resurface hard feelings, Amy. I'm not sure whether it's going to lead to anything more than sort of some commemorations scattered around and some proclamations at the UN level and elsewhere. But other than that, I get more of a sense from the reporting I've seen, Amy, of just this kind of soul searching and like, what is the state of international justice now? And what did it all accomplish following up Srebrenica with this major international effort?
And last question, I mean, the United States, you know, there's so much criticism in this country about whether we have or haven't abdicated our international responsibilities and roles of importance on our values, on our democratic values. And of course, we have our own debate in the country today, very active movements on social justice. Where do we stand as the United States in trying to prevent genocide throughout the world? And what do you see the United States? What should we be doing?
That's a good question, Amy. It's our colleague at CFR, David Scheffer, who was heavily involved in this whole international justice movement in the 90s, especially, and had been a U.S. ambassador at large for war crimes issues. He's pointed to the fact that you've had, under the Trump administration, the U.S. withdrawal from a number of organizations and initiatives aimed at supporting human rights. UN Human Rights Council, which the U.S. left partly because of the council's own failings, including its what's seen as a protecting of abusing nations, its emphasis on Israeli infractions and violations. And so there's this sort of withdrawal sentiment in the Trump administration. If they don't agree with the way an international body is working, they just leave it rather than try to reform it from within. And the U.S. has traditionally been really in the forefront of leading, even though it has not been part of the ICC and is now mitigating actively against it. There's still generally a strong U.S. movement towards protecting and trying to prevent rights abuses. This is a problem now under the Trump administration, which has definitely followed through in its America First attitude by not being as vigorous and consistent as the U.S. has been in the past in speaking out on human rights abuses. It definitely has spoken out on what's happened with the Uyghurs in China, as well as against China's crackdown in Hong Kong, for example. And in other parts around the world, it must be said the U.S. has still spoken out, but it's been certainly less consistent than in the past. President Trump himself has been more accommodating towards authoritarian leaders as well. And so you get mixed messaging at best in some cases from the U.S. You still, though, have a very large and vigorous, I think, NGO community in the U.S. that's involved in human rights issues. U.S. Congress cares about this in a bipartisan way. And so I think you have this sort of foundation of rights activists and rights watchdogs in the U.S. that remains, but, you know, without an administration that's strongly moving or that can be nudged in this direction, it does leave the world without a consistent leader in this regard. Amy, I want to turn my attention to something that you follow quite closely, which is the state of energy supplies, more particularly the state of energy pipelines. There are a slew of recent moves and decisions involving three in particular in recent days. These would be the pipelines, the Atlantic Coast, Dakota Access, and Keystone XL pipelines. These moves and decisions that I mentioned are seen as a big win for environmental groups, also indigenous communities that have protested pipelines across their lands. Can you talk a bit about what is happening here, Amy, and walk us through what has just played out and what will play out?
Well, it's a very interesting time in this space. Three major events that have been years in the making. The Supreme Court upheld a district court ruling that one segment of the Keystone Pipeline that involves waterways again has been faced an inadequate environmental test for its impact on wildlife, and that the federal agencies for wildlife were not properly consulted, and therefore that whole process needs to start again. Now, this is a huge pipeline. It extends from Canada. There are sections that go all the way to Texas. And so there are some segments that will not be affected by this ruling and are, you know, in operation, but it does again sort of send a shot across the bow of the industry in terms of process. Definitely halts the Trump administration, you know, in its tracks in terms of this process of fast tracking, showing that it's pretty hard to implement. And it carries great weight because, of course, it came from the Supreme Court. And there had been an effort to knock out all cross-water pipeline project permitting for a period of time. And the court did not opt to extend to a broader situation. But Keystone Pipeline, of course, is a headline news that many people know about in this country because it was so in the news for years and years. And so it's a big decision coming out of the Supreme Court. Now, one of the interesting things is sort of the back context of these landmark decisions. One of the big reevaluations we're having as a society in general is to really come to understand that there are underprivileged communities or underrepresented communities, communities of color, indigenous communities, whose interests were put aside for the efficiency of energy facilities. And this question of social justice when it comes to where we site our energy facilities, where we site our landfill and facilities that have big impacts is really, I think, going to be a much bigger electoral issue coming forward into the presidential elections. But I think over time, at all levels, local and state.
I think it's also happening at this kind of crucial moment of, even before the pandemic hit, of a strong consideration about moving more towards renewable energy and the big boom in that area in the U.S., even while the U.S. fossil fuel industry had been a bit of a roll. Could you talk a little bit about, Amy, about what the oil and gas industry has been facing now prior to these judgments even, and what it's looking at in terms of its viability, you know, in the foreseeable future?
Well, you know, there are big questions. How fast will we switch to cleaner energy? And what will that mean for existing infrastructure and for the build out of new infrastructure? So what we've seen is that the investment community and the banking community have become much more conservative about providing finance to the oil and gas industry. And we've seen a decapitalization. In other words, the value of equity, so stocks on the New York stock market for some of these companies has really taken a nosedive, especially since the COVID crisis, but it was even trending before that. You know, the news this week, which is a very interesting piece of news, which is that the stock value, the market capitalization, I should say, of Tesla exceeds ExxonMobil now, which is just unprecedented. But I think it's indicative of the fact that investors are taking a forward look on where they believe the world is going, and they're less interested in investing in the oil and gas industry, which is increasingly being seen as a sunsetting industry, even though we all know that we have, in, say, in the United States, you know, 270 million cars on the road, and only a couple million of them are electric. There's still this sense that we could go through this transition, and that we will go to this transition eventually, you know, across the board for our different uses of energy, whether that's in power generation and transportation and so forth. It's been very impactful on the industry, and these decisions just worsen the outlook for the industry's ability to raise capital to do its projects.
Yeah, and I guess the question is going to be how messy a transition that's going to be in terms of jobs destroyed, jobs created, and the track record is a bit murky on that front more recently in the U.S.
Well, and it's murky in multiple different ways because this year, unfortunately, we've had jobs destructed both in the traditional fossil fuel industry and in renewable energy.
Right.
So this is not a good thing because this is a highly trained field with you need a lot of background in engineering and so forth. So we don't want to lose that workforce. And then you have places that have come up with some sort of creative regulatory approaches at the local level. New York City, for example, had this new program program called Call for Solutions. So when you have an area in the city where there's been brownouts or problems with electricity reliability, instead of just letting the utility, you know, slap down a new power station or a new transformer, which can cost, you know, billions of dollars, they've done these calls for solutions, which is to look to see if in a particular location, a small scale solution, for example, solar panels backed up by batteries or other kinds of fixes that involve better technology, software, clean energy, and so forth. And that program has been very successful, but it's not being implemented yet nationally, and it's happening slowly. And of course, we're all users of energy hanging in the balance because we need reliable supply more than ever, especially in light of the pandemic. And yet we don't have a federal policy that moves that ball forward. And that's very damaging right now. Bob, let's take a few minutes now, since I've mentioned it, to focus on what's happening on the coronavirus front. More specifically, how COVID-19 has triggered historic levels of food insecurity, even in the United States and across the globe. You and Jim spoke before on the podcast about supply chain challenges spurred on by coronavirus. But catch us up to speed. Where are we now on the issue?
Well, I think what we can talk about is really a looming global crisis, Amy, on food and food security, what the professionals call food security. And I'm going to peg some of my information on a briefing I attended virtually just the other day via CFR with the World Food Program Chief David Beasley, who's a former U.S. governor. And he kind of walked through where they're seeing. This is the biggest international agency involved in feeding people. 100 million people rely on it for food on a regular basis. And the numbers he laid out are just staggering. They're of historic proportions. And they were bad before the virus hit. So he said before the virus hit, there was something like 135 million people who were food insecure. That number is basically doubled now. What that means is these are people on the path to starvation if they are not provided with a reliable stream of food. So there were conditions in place that made this bad to begin with. They're the standard ones, whether it's conflict and the various complications caused by conflict. For example, we're seeing playing out in Syria right now a real concern about feeding up to 3 million people in one of its more difficult corridors right now in the north. And the Security Council hasn't been able to agree on establishing a humanitarian pathway to bring food and other relief supplies in there. This could get resolved by the time this podcast airs, but it's among the many, many situations where there are vulnerable populations that are relying or almost wholly dependent on organizations like the World Food Program for aid. But we're also seeing climate extremes that are forcing people on the move or that have devastated crops. We're seeing this huge infestation of desert locusts in East Africa right now that have damaged crops and are still, you know, multiplying. We talked about that in the podcast previously. These are locust numbers in the trillions right now. And basically throughout Africa, there are all sorts of circumstances that are creating stresses, but it's not confined to Africa or the Middle East. It's also, we're seeing it increasingly in our own hemisphere, especially in Central and South America. David Beasley mentioned that if certain situations and certain conditions that were exacerbated by the pandemic do not improve, you could see new flights of people. And typically, these are people who are heading north to try to seek relief and asylum in the U.S. That's on top of what has been a steady surge of people from Central America due to instability in their countries there. So it all sort of compounds existing problems, Amy, and it's putting pressure on the international organizations that are on the front lines to try to provide both stopgap and steady supply, but also to try to create conditions in which people do not need to leave their homes. People are able to generate their own food and supply chains are able to be restored. That's still months off, if anything. And I'll just conclude by saying that David Beasley also talked about the concern of what they call food nationalism with countries that are not allowing supplies, especially commodities, to leave their boundaries because of their own concern and because of their own domestic supply chain disruptions. I mean, a great deal was made about some of the disruptions in the U.S. early on in the pandemic with everything from toilet paper to meat supplies. A number of those have seemed to have been restored, although there are still food insecurity problems in the U.S. that continue to be very visible just because of the economic privation with so many people losing work and people who are living sort of paycheck to paycheck really needing to go to food banks. And so these epic traffic jams for people lining up for food banks, those are continuing. So we're looking at a situation in this country, but really globally, Amy, where food insecurity has been intensified under the virus. And this, like so many other things, is going to need international coordination to kind of sort out and provide some sort of steady pathway before the numbers get even worse.
Well, Bob, I mean, this is sort of a very concerning development, and thinking about solutions, you know, twofold, because if people are on the move because of food deprivation, then we're in a worse situation in terms of the dissemination of the virus. So how do international agencies cope with the dual challenge of providing food and having refugees stay safe and having their own personnel stay safe?
It's not easy. It's one of the bigger challenges that these organizations, which it must be said, have done amazing work through the years. It's one of the bigger challenges in terms of the multiple spillover crises that they're facing that they've had to deal with. And it's this David Beasley briefing that I listened in on. He was talking about the challenge of just merely getting aircraft to be able to go and fly safely to the zones where relief workers are needed, to be there in the field, and also to actually load up these aircraft and bring them over there and not get infected themselves. A number of relief workers have been infected, and the last thing they want to do is also infect the populations they're trying to help. So they're taking all the precautions that are well familiar in terms of masking, sanitizing, and so forth. They're getting help from the private sector. They're hoping for more in that area, but donated equipment and logistics help. It's really going to be an across the board effort to try to ramp up assistance to them to be able to bring help. I would mention another interesting offshoot that we're seeing, and it's been reported on in places like The Economist and Financial Times, is that you're starting to see, hearkening back to the old World War II victory gardens, you're starting to see people planting their own gardens. And I'm talking about more in the developed world, say, than the developing world, but it is a phenomenon that's expanding now. People are planting food in their local plots, and they're getting better at it. And so that's going to be something interesting to watch as we deal with this kind of new normal going forward. But on the broader scale that I was talking about initially, it really is going to be the richer countries with more wherewithal just helping to both step up. David Beasley mentioned the U.S. has, for example, increased by multiple billions its donation to the World Food Program. But stepping up their donations, there's 10 to 12 donors that are typically make up almost 85% of the world donations in food. So whether or not that group can be expanded or just, they are able to dig deeper and do the multiple steps that are needed. This was also playing out recently, Amy, in the refugee problem. On top of the food scarcity and sort of alongside it has been a historic rise in refugees, and the numbers are in the close to 200 million or so. Who cares for those? Well, the previous asylum paths have been closed off to countries like the US and Western Europe. These people are in massive camps, and there are efforts to try to deal with situations that created this flight, whether it's brokering peace deals in Africa, or what's still being tried in places like Myanmar, which is it at all possible that the Rohingya who fled amid charges of genocide, whether they could ever go back to that country, or whether or not their vast refugee settlements in Bangladesh are going to establish a sense of permanency, or whether they in some ways get integrated into Bangladeshi society. It's not clear. There are some refugee populations that have been there for generations, have been around the world for generations. Think about Afghanistan refugees, for example, and in Pakistan, or, take your pick in the Middle East as well. So it's, I wish I would say there are bold solutions on the horizon, but it's going to be more kind of plugging away at just making sure that sort of this triage moment that food is there before starvation sets in. So Amy, we've talked our way into the figures of the week section of the podcast. And so I'll start with you. Who or what is your figure of the week?
Well, I'm deciding that my figure of the week is John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court and the court itself, because we've seen several amazing landmark decisions come out in the last couple of weeks, and all of which I think really speak to the fact that the court is independent of national politics. We've seen some decisions that were hailed by conservatives and some decisions that were hailed by people on the left end of the political spectrum, and we're showing that the court is still delivering independent rule of law, which, of course, is very important for our democracy. So, John Roberts, you are my person of the week.
Reports came out this week that he actually suffered an injury that occurred several weeks ago, but just came to the light of day. He suffered a fall and hurt his head, had to be, I think, admitted to a hospital, if I'm not mistaken.
That is true. And also, Ruth Bader Ginsburg has also had some health challenges. And it really just shows you the nature of the people who sit on the Supreme Court and their commitment, because this is not an easy matter to read all the briefs and write the opinions and so forth if you're not feeling perfectly well. But the court is functioning at social distance. And we, you know, there's a lot of staff that keeps the gears moving. So we're just very lucky that the Chief Justice was not disrupted in his execution of these tasks and these important cases. We've had some very important decisions, whether it's defending the rights of the LGBTQ community. We had another landmark decision upholding the rights of public funds to be used for students, to support students going to faith-based schools. So across the board, today, of course, we had the decision about the court upholding the release of the president's financial returns. So a very independent court and lots of changes coming and moving forward on different important issues.
Yes, and as we're seeing on the latter one, Amy, I'm seeing reports that the court allowed the release of the president's financial records to New York prosecutors, but not to the House of Representatives. So a split decision of sorts there.
And I think that's sort of an interesting outcome, because I think the court, both by making some decisions that have gone with precedent, and also in this case where we're talking about a rule of law issue, I think this court has made it clear that it tends to defend both precedent and rule of law in the United States and be independent. And, you know, there's nothing more important than that when it comes to, you know, our future and thinking about all the issues we're facing, whether they're issues of social justice, whether they're issues of federal versus state. And we have a lot of important issues that need to be adjudicated. How about you, Bob? What is your figure?
Amy, my figure is a number, and it is 165 million. That's the number of times the short video app TikTok has been downloaded in the United States. And I picked that number because TikTok is under consideration for having its short video app banned. I should say the company, the parent company, which is China's ByteDance Limited, is facing that decision. This was mentioned by First Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, then President Trump mentioned it as well, for various reasons. One, the president said it was a possible way to retaliate against China because of its handling of the coronavirus. So a bit of a reprisal move. We've also heard, though, that maybe it's a way, according to Secretary of State Pompeo, of protecting American citizens' private data. It's not a definitive decision. There's a lot of things at stake here. Certainly for a great many Americans, including my daughters, the loss of TikTok would be a major development on the social front. But we'll have to see how this plays out. It does point to yet another potential fault line between U.S. and China. Just earlier today, there was some statements from the Chinese foreign minister about the U.S. and Chinese relations being at their lowest point in 40 years, but also trying to lay out ways in which the countries can work together or in some areas agree to disagree and so forth. But you could probably pick a U.S.-China issue every week for a figure of the week, Amy, at this point.
Well, I think that's certainly true, Bob. And, you know, I think one of the fundamental fault lines is in this area of technology and how it's used. Because here in the United States, we are debating and trying to come up with the right formula to protect the privacy of people vis-a-vis all these devices and data. We are having difficulty navigating social media and what's appropriate for social media, not appropriate for social media. We are, in dealing with the pandemic, I think probably here in the United States, people would be reluctant to let their government come into their communication devices and track their health. You could see, you know, so many ways that your personal freedom could be abused if that kind of a surveillance were to become widespread. It sounds like it sounds okay when it's coming to public health, but then what if that data was used in a different way? And so, you know, and we've all been through the experience of the Patriot Act and the debate about how much of that act should stay in place and not stay in place. So a lot of issues being actively debated in the United States against the knowledge that China has created a surveillance state where they use facial recognition software to repress the population, where in China, you can lose your complete access to housing, credit, jobs. If you take an action and they identify you either through facial recognition software or through your social media use, where that they decide is against the government, that can be used in ways against individuals and against human rights. And then you have China exporting some of that methodology as as part of its Belt and Road Initiative, teaching other governments that are repressive how to use these tools. And so to me, I think as we move down the road, this is going to be a major fault line that's going to be very difficult to navigate. There are other areas on climate change, on even on public health, on conflict resolution, where the United States and China have some common interests and should be able to work together. But this one area that the TikTok controversy highlights is one where I think it's going to be a very, very choppy waters in terms of the bilateral relationship.
Yeah, I think you really encapsulated it, Amy. And I would just note also the U.S. FBI director this week, in addition, cited the fact that China's actions in the cybersecurity space, among other things, are keeping the FBI busy and opening up new files on a regular basis in areas of concern about national security and data protection, everything else. So for all the reasons you just cited, the TikTok decision is going to be taken very carefully, but it's just one of many, many ones during this sort of cascading, you know, confrontation that seems to be looming between the U.S. and China.
And I think it opens up an area in terms of foreign policy where really maybe what's needed, but could be maybe too difficult to implement, is some kind of rules of the road between the United States and China, kind of like arms negotiation for how we're going to manage the cyberspace and what is going to be off limits for civilians. That dialogue has not progressed as far as it needs to, and probably is going to be a major element going forward if we're going to try to have sort of a more cooperative relationship between the United States and China.
Yes, indeed.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The second round of Poland's presidential election is held. The European Parliament Foreign Affairs Committee will be meeting in Brussels. And Singapore also has a general election.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collis. Thanks, Zoe. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Bob McMahon saying goodbye, and thanks a lot, Amy, for joining the cast.
And this is Amy Myers-Jaffe saying so long, and have a good week.